You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. As, you know, yesterday I told you the Ukraine, or Ukraine now it's called, Ukraine is in flames. At the moment, things are calm, but at the moment, it's like, the middle of the night, or getting close to it. It must be around 11 or midnight or something like that in Ukraine right this minute. And so in our third hour today, Stephen Cohen is going to come on, and we're going to try and take the whole hour, get your calls, have a conversation about this. I really want to get into some depth in this. I promised this to you yesterday. We're going to try and do that today. Stephen is a Russia expert. And a Ukraine expert, actually. EU leaders condemn Ukraine for violence, the West's policy goals in Ukraine. Interesting headline up at the top. Let me just juxtapose two things. You'll recall back in 2006, those of you who have been longtime listeners to or viewers of this program, will recall that in 2006, when I was doing this show from Portland, actually, and the housing starts stalled. As my recollection is 32%. I referenced the exact numbers and the exact time in my new book, The Crash of 2016. I don't have it right at the tip of my brain right now. But it was in that neighborhood. And I went out and by coincidence, I've told you the story a number of times, but it bears repeating. By coincidence, I was at that time reading a book about the history of the Great Depression. I didn't even know, for example, that nobody ever referred to it as the Great Depression until after 1940. And then it was called the Republican Great Depression for most of the decade of the 40s and the early 50s until the election of Eisenhower. Then they basically, in 52, then they basically stopped calling it the Republican Great Depression and just called it the Great Depression. But that phrase didn't come into popular usage. Franklin Roosevelt called it our crisis, our current crisis, and a variety of other things. So anyhow, I was reading this history of the Republican Great Depression of 1929 through 1941, and the author of this book was talking about how, you know, in 1921, President Harding dropped the top income tax rate from 95% down to 91% down to 25%. That created this huge wad of hot money in the hands of the really, really rich, and they started speculating with this money in both the stock market and the real estate market, which inflated both the stock market and real estate market, which caused average working people to jump into the stock market and the real estate market and ride it up. And now they had hot money, too. And all this hot money just, you know, fed on itself. And we had this bubble where the stock market was, you know, doubling and tripling. Real estate prices were quintupling, tenfolding. And it all burst. It started bursting. The housing market started bursting in 1927, as I recall, either late 26 or early 27, with housing starts stalling by about a third. That was followed a year and a half, 2 years later, by the stock market itself crashing. Because as the housing market crashed, it sucked all this money out of the economy, and in order to make up for the losses in the housing market, people had to start selling their stocks. And as they started selling their stocks, you know, the stock market crashed. In other words, it was just the exact reverse process. Well, this morning on the news, I get this story about how housing starts are down. Numbers are just in from December. And I believe January. And housing starts are down. Now, it might be that this is because bad weather was so bad that people just said, screw it. You know, I'm not going to buy a house. There were fewer mortgages written. There was less demand. Or it could be that the some of the home builders said, you know, we're not going to build houses in this weather. Or it could be that the bubble's starting to burst. If so, then we can expect that 6 months, a year, year and a half down the road, we'll see the stock market follow it, if that's the case. So that went through my mind this morning as I was listening to that news story while I was waking up. And then I come into work and pop up Financial Times here on my computer. And what's the number one story? Well, actually, earlier this morning, the number one story was Ukraine being in flames. But the number one story right now is that they got a hold of the minutes for the January Fed meeting. Now, the Fed has been inflating our economy or providing stimulus to our economy by buying toxic assets from the banks to the tune of $40 or $45 billion a month and buying treasuries to the tune of $40 or $45 billion a month. And now I think that's both those numbers have dropped by $5 or $10 billion a month over the last couple of months as they taper out of this so-called quantitative easing, which is basically just, you know, we're going to relieve the banks of their bad money and we're going to throw some money at the federal government. You know, we're going to create demand for bonds, which keeps inflation rate low, which keeps the bond prices low, which keeps inflation rate low. But most importantly, it keeps the price at which the banks can borrow money low so that the banks, in theory, will take that money from the Fed very, very cheap, less than a 1% interest, and loan it out to you to buy a house for a low interest rate, for 4 or 5% instead of 9 or 10%, and make a nice little profit in the process, or loan it to businesses and things like that. Well, the banks have not been so cooperative. What they're doing is they're taking the money from the Fed at a tenth of a percent or something. This is ridiculously cheap money, and they're buying treasuries, which are paying a little over a percent right now, and just sitting on the money and making, you know, they're making money on the spread, right? No risk whatsoever. But anyhow, the headline over at the Financial Times today is strong support inside Fed for tapering. And the subhead really says the whole thing. Minutes of January meeting, so show few doubts on the economy. So the Fed right now is thinking the same way that America was thinking in 1926, 1927. Things are getting better. Right. So that concerns me considerably. Another thing I wanted to bring up, and we're going to get into, by the way, at the bottom of the hour, Joe Madison is going to drop by, and he's going to be with us for the last half hour of this first hour. And he and I will be taking your calls. We're going to talk a little bit, and I want to open up the phone lines then, about this whole Michael Dunn, Jordan Davis thing. What kind of signal does it send when a white guy can get exonerated or at least not convicted of murder of a black guy simply by saying I was afraid of him? You know, what kind of message is that sending? What does that say about the state of American society? By the way, did you know in Mexico City, in all of Mexico, actually, it's legal to hold up to 5 grams of cannabis, but in Mexico City, there's a party. It's called the Party of the Democratic Revolution, and they're members of the Mexico City legislature. They want to raise it to 30 grams and open coffee shops, pot coffee shops in Mexico City. Turns out pot is the most widely used drug in Mexico. Very, very interesting. Oh, and I've got the anti-union pledge card for you. I got to share that with you. So, anyhow, we'll be back in a few minutes with all of these things and more.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, of course, you can learn all about it and sign up for our newsletter. Get all the information over at TomHartman.com. It's free. We don't share the list with anybody. It's just you. Welcome back. Andrew Campbell, senior producer with The Big Picture, on the line with us. Andrew, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So, Jordan Davis, Murder by Culture, our opening rant.
Yeah, we'll be getting into that. We'll be talking a little bit more about the situation that played out this weekend. As most people know, Dunn was convicted on 3 counts of attempted murder and a count of shooting into a moving vehicle, but the jury was hung on the first-degree murder charge for killing Jordan Davis. And we'll really get into what stand-your-ground laws allow for, and that is that really, you really only have to assert that you're afraid of black people now and get a jury to believe you to get off with murder. And getting a jury to believe you is very likely, considering that society and culture in America today is biased towards this notion that black people are scary and white people aren't.
Right. Well, at least the majority of white society is biased toward that idea. Well, and I suppose probably some Hispanics and some African Americans. I mean, it's going to be an interesting conversation because Horace Cooper and Kevin Martin, who are our guests tonight in the Lone Liberal Rumble, and that will be the first topic, are both African Americans and are both conservatives and have both on various occasions on my program asserted that they don't think that racism is that big a deal anymore, sort of the Clarence Thomas position.
Right.
So we'll see where that goes. Some of the other things we're going to cover in the Rumble?
We'll be getting into the GOP embracing everyone's favorite lunatic Ted Nugent. The Republican gubernatorial candidate down in Texas has basically accepted support from Nugent, despite Nugent's long history of making absolutely ridiculous and hateful comments.
What was the phrase, his most recent phrase, that he used to describe the President of the United States?
President Obama, about 2 months ago, a subhuman mongrel.
And subhuman mongrel is verbatim the phrase that the Nazis used to describe Jews.
Correct. And this is somebody that the GOP is letting in with open arms. Pretty wild.
Yeah, it is pretty wild.
We'll also talk about the latest out of West Virginia. We're now a month and a half since the January 9th spill, and still very little is being done there. There are still reports that the water is contaminated. There are reports that the water openly smells like the chemicals that spilled into it. The companies that were responsible haven't been held accountable, and it's really still a mess down there. So we'll get into that, and it'll lead into a debate on the corporate death penalty.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And our next block, Block D, transparency in the courts?
Yeah, actually,
in Block C,
we're going to have on Steve Cohen. He's the contributing editor with The Nation magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be talking about the upheaval and the chaos that's going on right now in the Ukraine. We'll get into the complexities of the situation and why there's all this violence, so it should be a really interesting discussion.
Yeah, I agree. And, in fact, he's going to be with us for an hour here on this program, the third hour of the program, so we'll have a thoughtful conversation.
Yeah.
And then, finally, the Coalition for Court Transparency.
Yeah, the group has launched a new campaign urging the Supreme Court justices to allow cameras in the courtroom. And this is obviously, the Supreme Court is basically the last branch of government that doesn't openly allow cameras.
Now, here's my question. Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution says that the Supreme Court shall operate under regulations established by Congress. Why doesn't Congress just establish a rule that the court has to have cameras?
It's a good question. We'll get to that tonight.
Cool. Okay. Andrew Campbell, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
And we will see, I'll see Andrew again, and you will see us doing the big picture tonight at 7 o'clock. We'll be back. It's past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We have the anti-union pledge card. This is for Joe the Plumber, I suppose. You hear this? Joe the Plumber got a job in Toledo, Ohio, working at a Chrysler plant, and he's now a union member. His real name is Samuel Wurzelbach. There was a brief period of time there where he was a conservative commentator. He went over to Israel to see the situation in Israel. And he was offered to us as a guest on our program, and they submitted a form that I had to sign, which I've never done before and I've never done since. But I thought, what the heck? And this form said that I would only ask him questions about his area of expertise. Now, I know that what they were trying to say is don't pick on the poor guy, don't give him trick questions, don't try to ask him questions about things he doesn't know about, don't try to make him look stupid. So I signed the form and I sent it back to them and they said, cool, we'll put him on your show. So he came on our show and for the full 15 minutes of the segment, we talked about plumbing. That's all we talked about. And he was very, you know, he very happily told me, you know, the best ways to unplug a drain. And in fact, I asked him, Carl Wolfson, who was doing the morning show on KPOJ at the time, I said, Carl, you got any questions for Sam? And he says, yeah, do people ever hit on you? You know, if you're in a lot of people's houses, these women ever come on to you? And Joe's like, oh, you wouldn't believe it. You know, it's like a dating service. Anyhow, that's out there on the interweb someplace. You can listen to that show. But so the trade union left forum came up with this anti-union pledge card. And as an opponent of trade unionism, I pledge to reject the workplace rights and benefits won by trade unions over the past 150 years. I hereby authorize my employer to refuse me all of the following: annual leave, pay increases, sick leave, lunch breaks, the 8-hour day, pensions, redundancy pay, that would be unemployment insurance, the weekend, this must be from the UK, the weekend, health and safety, unfair dismissal protection, and maternity or paternity leave. Signed, you know. Right. Sounds like a plan, right? Doesn't it? Lynn in John Day, Oregon. Hey, Lynn, what's on your mind?
Well, you were talking on the news about the Republicans being up in air over the loss of 500,000 jobs.
Mm-hmm.
If we raise them. What about the 2.4 million we've lost in the past decade? And if you go back to 76 when we started the visa programs, it's more than that.
Right. Yeah, this is just to provide people with some context for what you're talking about, Lynn. The Congressional Budget Office just came out with a report saying that if the minimum wage was raised to $10.10 an hour, it would benefit 95% of all minimum wage workers, but there would be a loss of 500,000 jobs, according to them, roughly, plus or minus. And, you know, a lot of us, including 600 economists and 7 Nobel Prize winners, disagree and think that there would be a net increase in jobs. But the fact of the matter is 95%. But the Republicans are all hysterical about this. Oh, if we raise the minimum wage, you're going to lose 500,000 jobs. And you're absolutely right. Where were those Republicans when 2.5 million jobs got outsourced just during the Bush administration, basically? And then, you know, probably another 10 million got outsourced going all the way back to, you know, Nixon cracking open the door to China and all these other trade policies. Solid, spot on, Lynn. Thank you very much. That's brilliant. Richard in Lebanon, Missouri. Hey, Richard, you have a story to tell about unemployment extension?
Yes, sir.
Go for it.
Last July, I was laid off from a company I worked for 4 years. Well, actually, twice. They laid me off once before, so I got about 7 years in total.
Mm-hmm.
And I got my unemployment, and, of course, in December it ended. And I was 62 years old at the top of my pay scale. And I waited for the watch and C-SPAN, waiting for the Congress or Senate to pass these extension rights.
So you could continue to get unemployment benefits.
Yes.
Right.
And, of course, it never did. So I was basically forced to retire to go and apply for Social Security.
Right. And if you're 62, you can get Social Security, but you get it at a reduced rate.
Yes, sir. And I talked to Claire McCaskill and Roy Blunt's office here in town, here in Springfield, and I tried to call Vicki Hartzler. I think she's a representative for the Congress.
Right.
But I never could get through to her either here or in Washington.
Huh. She's a Republican?
Yeah.
The Republicans typically don't answer their phones when you try to call a Republican member of Congress. The Democrats always do, but the Republicans typically don't give a...
Yeah.
They frankly don't give a rat's ass about what their constituents think.
That's exactly right, because Roy Blunt's office was pretty rude, and Claire McCaskill...
He's your Republican senator. Claire McCaskill is your Democratic senator.
Yes. And her people was inquisitive and asked me questions. And, you know, I'm a Vietnam veteran, too.
Uh-huh.
The minimum wage, they need to raise that as high as they can get it.
So here we have Richard, who served his country in Vietnam, which was a hell of a risk back in the day. I'm old enough to remember it. I didn't go. You did. I salute you for that, sir. Served your country. Worked the rest of your life, you know, hardworking person all your life, 62, your company goes down, you get laid off, and can't find a job.
The company really didn't go down. What they done, new owners come in, bought the company, and immediately laid off 75 to 100 people.
Yeah. Okay. So it was one of these kind of...
Who was that 30 years, 15 years? Anybody top pay scale? Gone.
Yeah. So they did it the way that Mitt Romney does it with Bain Capital, basically. That's an amazing story. Richard, thank you for sharing it with us. I wish you the very best, and I hope you can make it through here on Social Security. I know it's going to be a real change for you. Thank you for calling and sharing your story. We need to be hearing people's stories and getting it that, you know, people have to cope when the Republicans filibuster long-term unemployment benefits, as they did just a few weeks ago. People have to come up with Plan B.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Richard's fortunate. He was 62. He was old enough for Plan B to be Social Security. A lot of people, their Plan B is the homeless shelter. Minutes before they are. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And we are working to get Joe on the phone right now. I have not succeeded so far, so we're working on that. By the way, do you have Verizon Fios? I'm hearing reports from people who have Verizon Fios who are trying to watch Netflix who are saying, you know, my Netflix isn't coming down. I mean, I can't, you know, I'm having a hard time watching Netflix. I'm paying all this money for the super high-speed Fios, the fiber optic stuff. And it looks like Verizon and Netflix are having a little bit of a problem. And Netflix is speaking out. They're starting to speak out and say, hey, wait a minute, this isn't right. You shouldn't be doing this. And Verizon is basically saying, yeah, you don't like it. Tough luck. Joe Madison is with us, the host of The Joe Madison Show, airing weekdays 6 to 10 a.m. on Sirius Channel 128. His website, joemadison.com. Joe, welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me, and I hope the quality is okay. I'm doing grandfather duties, picking up my grandson from school, so this is a perfect time. I'm caught in Washington traffic.
Okay. Well, the audio sounds fine, and you can hang with us for the next 25 minutes?
I think we can work that out.
Okay, great. We at quarter two, we have a hard bump into a break. We'll continue. It'll just be about six seconds out. We'll continue with our TV and nonprofit Pacifica affiliates through that break. There'll be a hard bump out, and we'll come back at 10 to rejoin all our commercial stations, and that'll take us to the top of the hour, okay?
All right.
Okay.
We'll see what we can work out, sure.
Just so you know our clock. And I wanted to invite our listeners to call in if you want to talk with Joe. Joe Madison is here with us. Joe, you and I talked after the verdict came down in this case of the murder of Jordan Davis, but we didn't know what the jury was thinking or what was going on in the jury room. Now one of the jurors has come out and said that originally it was 10-2 for conviction, and it ended up 9-3 for conviction, but it had to be unanimous because it was first-degree murder. But the state of Florida allows a jury to change the charge. The charge was first-degree murder. The jury could have said, well, okay, we're deadlocked on first-degree murder, but we're going to convict him of second-degree murder, in other words, without premeditation, but with malice, or we're going to convict him of manslaughter. No malice. It was an accident, but one that could have or should have been avoided. What are your thoughts? What are your listeners saying? I'm curious about both.
Well, let's start with what my listeners are saying. To the person, they are outraged. Again, they firmly believe, like juror number four said in the interview, that basically got away with murder.
Right.
I wasn't aware of all the things you just said in reference to what Florida law allows, so that really didn't come up. Because my audience for the course, and we've been going at this since the verdict came down on Saturday, Tom, they believe that it should have been first-degree murder. They find it ironic at how you can actually find him guilty of second degree attempted murder, and then when a killing is actually committed, it's not murder. It just did not make any sense. So clearly, they're now talking about repealing this law. And people are also talking about selective buying campaigns, another word for boycotting the state of Florida.
Hmm.
So there are people who are outraged to the point that they're prepared to take some kind of action, and they're looking at other states that have stand your ground law. We even talked to an activist in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
That said, that a stand your ground, and I'm calling it a shoot first law.
Stand your ground, shoot first.
That's right. Change the terminology.
Yeah.
And they are now saying that a similar law is in committee in Ohio. So, so that's where we are with this. But clearly, Tom, there were 2 to 3 people in that room who believed that stand your ground was what should have been considered.
Joe, isn't this, and shouldn't we be recognizing this as a cultural statement that a white man can go before a jury and say that he is so fearful of black teenagers that he and the jury ends up essentially agreeing with him that he legitimately feared for his life in large part because they were black and therefore had to shoot. Whereas had it been a black man who was saying to a car full of, my computer just went nuts. If it was a black man who was saying to a car full of white teenagers who were all, you know, preppies from Andover or something, saying I was so afraid I had to shoot into their car, a jury wouldn't buy that there's no fear. That what we're seeing here is a continuation of this, of that piece of our culture, and that the stand your ground, shoot first laws basically legalized the murder of African Americans based on the cultural norm, at least in the white community, of, oh my God, those people are scary, but do not legalize the murder of anybody else.
Yeah. I mean, look, first of all, you and I have been around long enough to know that it's all based on stereotype and perception, of the undervaluing, underestimating, the marginalizing of black life. This is not new. This goes back to the beginning of this country.
Yep.
And it runs deep. I refer to it as cultural conditioning. And cultural conditioning is something that's very real. But you've explained it does go on. There's no ifs, ands, buts about it. Look, it goes on with targeting. Do you remember the days of when if you drove a nice car down the New Jersey Turnpike, or you went down 95 here on the East Coast, maybe let's say from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C., you could be pulled over, and older black people who had nice cars were pulled over. Their cars were searched only because of the perception that they might be drug dealers.
Right.
Look, this goes on with, it's a part of our culture. If a black person moves into a predominantly white neighborhood, then you've got blockbusting going on by realtors. I mean, that's how deep it goes. And I said it this morning on my show. If that had been some WWF wrestlers, four white guys, who look like NFL football linemen playing loud music in their car, I guarantee you he wouldn't have gone over there and said a word to those folks. You know, there's something called mind your own business, and that's all he had to do was mind his own business. I've gone into gas stations. You have gone into gas stations. Kids are thumping the music, it's coming across the speaker so loud it vibrates on your chest. You sort of shake your head, but you don't go over and tell them turn the music down. I mean, you mind your own business. You get what you're going to buy, and you move on. And
right.
You can say what you want to about them, but you don't go pulling a gun out.
Yeah.
This is just you know, Tom. It's deep in this country. It is very, very deep. And here's the sad. Here's something I think people ought to understand. No matter what your color is, there's an entire generation of young people who aren't going to put up with it. They're not going to be fearful. They're not going to be intimidated. My children are that way. They are respectful. And you know my children.
Mm-hmm.
They're very respectful, very intelligent kids. But you know what? They've been taught to be their own person.
Yeah.
And they're not going to sit up there and be intimidated by somebody simply because they don't like their music or be perceived as thugs because they don't.
Doesn't this verdict say to black teenagers, look out for white people?
No, I don't think so. I wouldn't say that. I think what this verdict says is that what you just said at the beginning of this at this interview, that a black life is less valued than a white life.
Oh, well, that's my point. You know, look out for white people because they can shoot you with impunity, basically.
Well, you better hope that that's not the case because there might be some black kids that might shoot back.
I'm with you. I'm with you.
We better hope that that's not the case.
Okay, Joe. Here comes that bump out I was telling you about. We'll be hang on to the phone though. Stick around with us. We'll be back with more of Joe Madison. Got a bunch of people who are calling in too. Want to get in on this conversation, so we'll open it up right after this. Joe Madison with the Joe Madison Show on Sirius XM. JoeMadison.com is his website. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can tweet Joe at Black Eagle Power. We'll be right back. And welcome back. We've got Joe Madison on the line with us. Joe, you're still there?
Oh, I'm still here.
Okay, great.
So is my grandson listening to this conversation.
Oh, great. Well, our greetings to your grandson. We are now talking to our Pacifica and Free Speech TV audience, and David in Victorville, California, watching us on Free Speech TV. You are on the air with Joe Madison.
My brother-in-law lives in Victorville, California.
You're
Roger territory.
Okay, I hope that's me you're referring to.
Not as Roy Rogers.
So here's the deal. I was one of the founders of the Latosha Hall as Justice Committee back in 1992 or thereabouts, where you had a young girl who was murdered, but the criminal justice system dealt with the young black girl, Latosha Hall, as though she was a perpetrator. Now, this was back in the 1992-1990 area.
Right.
Now, here we are, fast forward to where we're in 2014.
20 years later plus.
Where you have a system who did not, I mean, well, this has been a consistent thing, I guess, you know, be historically on point since we landed here. But further as black people are concerned, I heard you talking about your son, Joe, and them not tolerating or being of the mindset where this type of thing is readily acceptable. So now my question to us black people, I'll levy this out. When and how much longer do we continuously give deference and obedience to a system that we know and get our heart broke on a damn near daily basis in dealing with this injustice system? How long will we tolerate this?
Well,
that would be my question to everyone listening.
And
how long does this system think that we're going to keep tolerating?
Thank you, David. Joe?
Well, and I understand it's a rhetorical question, and let me tell you, and David sounds like many of the callers that I have. Here's my question that I always ask my callers.
what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? The reality is that most folks didn't vote in midterm elections. They allow these ALECs and these state legislators to put this law through because we don't even know who our state legislators are. Now I'm going to pull a page from Tom Hartman's playbook. This is where, and correct me if I'm wrong, Tom, this is where you get down on the grassroots level. You show up at these committee meetings, these district meetings,
yep.
these precinct meetings,
yep.
and you demand that this law be repealed. That's number one. This is where organizations, I don't care if it's fraternities, sororities, churches, where they talk about selective buying campaigns. You know, somebody once said, you hit people in their pocketbooks, their hearts and minds will follow. So when you ask the question, how long are we going to tolerate it? We're going to tolerate it as long as we're apathetic. And that's why this law spread to 20-plus states is because people were asleep. They don't know who their state legislator is. They've got your phone number to call in and make comments, Tom. They've got my phone number to call in and make comments, but they don't even have their state legislator or their congressman's number in their smartphone, and they don't make these calls, and that's how come this kind of thing is going on.
We'll be back with more of Joe Madison in just a second. Welcome back to Talk Media for the Rest of Us. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Joe Madison with us, joemadison.com, host of the Joe Madison Show on Sirius XM. Joe, you got another 8 minutes to be with us, right?
Oh, yeah, man. I'm just, like, I'm in Washington, D.C. traffic, and I'm amazed at how clear this the system sounds.
Yeah. No, it sounds just absolutely great.
And I appreciate it.
Okay. Let's get some more calls here. Joe, listening in Chevy Chase, Maryland on Progressive Voices. You're on the air with Joe Madison and me.
Yeah, thank you. A couple points to bring some neutrality to this whole thing. The main problem with the case in Florida was that they tried to get first-degree murder as opposed to second-degree murder. It's very clear the verdict would have been second-degree murder.
In Florida, the jury had the option of returning a second-degree murder conviction.
That's right.
They did.
They absolutely had that option. It was part of the jury instructions.
The second thing to list here, and I know it's not politically correct, but it's factual, and I'd be willing to have a nice, calm discussion about it, is that turning this whole thing into a racial thing is really,
it is a racial thing. You know, stop. I don't even want to start with that, and I'm sorry, Tom. It is a racial thing, and it's not a question of being rational. You know what really is ticking my audience off? Is the fact that the letters that man wrote from jail shows his state of mind towards black folk. And that really should have been brought into the trial, and it wasn't. The reality, it is a racial thing. It is him calling those young black kids thugs. He doesn't know what those kids were. They could have been president of the class. What he saw were four black faces. He had this predisposition that these kids were nothing but a bunch of young black thugs, and I'm telling you, for you to sit up there and suggest that it wasn't racial is absolutely absurd, and you're in denial. And therein lies the problem in this country. That's the problem in this country.
Yeah. Joe, tonight on my TV show, I've got the Lone Liberal Rumble, and we've got two guys from two African-Americans, conservatives, who I know from previous conversations are going to pretty much take a Clarence Thomas perspective on this. This is not a racial issue. Thoughts on how I should respond to that, to somebody who's actually African-American?
What I would do is, I'd read the letters. I'd read his letters. You know what I'd do? I'd have his staff pull out the letters he wrote from jail.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I would do. And then have them explain that. Look, you know, we've had black people who thought slavery was okay because everybody had a job. I'm not worried about two black conservatives who think that, oh, we're too sensitive about this.
Yeah,
you
I got
know,
it.
This is absolutely absurd conversation to be having. And I'll tell you what it's like. It's like, you know, saying if a woman wears a short skirt, she deserves to be raped or be sexually molested. I mean, it's an absurd position. And first of all, the guy who just called in, it off wrong, and you had to correct him. But, oh, he had that authoritative voice.
Yeah. You know, well, here's the facts. They could have, they should have tried him on that. Well, they could have changed the verdict right there in the jury room. So you had to correct him. Then he comes back with this, and here are the facts. This is not race. It's not a fact. It's an opinion. He's got an opinion. I've got an opinion. And quite candidly, I'm not going to have my opinion undervalued, underestimated, or marginalized by somebody who doesn't want to understand that this has been going on too long. You know, it's almost similar to Emmett Till. Remember, Emmett Till was murdered in the most horrific way. They had a trial. And what happened in that trial? Those men were found innocent by the jury, walked out the courtroom, did an interview with a monthly publication, and laughed and said, "We actually murdered Emmett Till."
Yeah.
Now, how many examples do you need in America?
Yeah, yeah, I'm absolutely with you. Jay in Port St. Lucie, Florida, you're on the air with Joe Madison.
Oh, good afternoon, Tom and Joe. Joe, I'm a listener to Urban Radio, so I hear you every morning.
Urban, thank you very much.
Yeah, hey, you want to know what am I going to do about it? I'm going to be with that demonstration. We're going up with Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson on the 10th of March up to Tallahassee to see the elected leaders up there. And I know who my representative is in my district in Port St. Lucie, and I talk to him at least once a week. And I let him know about what I feel like, but he has no power because the Republicans control Tallahassee. But we're going to be going up to demonstrate, and I just want to leave you with this. The sheriff of Pope County he's the president of the Association for Law Enforcement in the state of Florida, and he said on CNN his people support Stand Your Ground. Now, this is a law enforcement person who says he supports vigilante justice. He's
Joe.
The president of the Sheriff Association for the state of Florida.
Joe, your thoughts on Jay's comment?
Yeah. No, I mean, gee, the more things change, the more they stay the same. You know, we had sheriffs who were sergeant of arms for Ku Klux Klan folks. I mean, you know, we had ministers who were there who were chaplains. I mean, look, the reality is that I think we need to change the wording. Tom, and you and I do this a lot when we talk, I don't think it should be Stand Your Ground. I think that's a misnomer. It ought to be shoot first. That's what it ought to be. And it's a dangerous, and as Congresswoman Corrine Brown said after the verdict on Saturday, it's a sloppy law.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what she said. It's a sloppy law. And I support the fact that the demonstrations are going to take place up in Tallahassee, because if the leadership doesn't do it, here's what's going to happen. Young people are going, young white and black people are going to take the leadership on this. They're going to have the demonstrations. They're going to make the changes much the way they did in the 60s.
Hmm.
You watch and see, because they're the victims of this. Remember, 120 plus young African Americans were shot using this shoot first in just the state of Florida. In the state of Florida.
Well, okay. Joe Madison, host of The Joe Madison Show, airing 6 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Sirius Channel 128 and his website, joemadison.com. Joe, it's always a pleasure having you on. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Anytime. Thank you.
Give my best to Sherry, too.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com. Everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. and ecowine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at tomhartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And Lee Fong is with us, a contributor to RepublicReport.org, The Nation magazine, author of the book The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right, is the website where his current reporting is, RepublicReport.org. Lee, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thank you so much for having me.
It is always an honor and a pleasure to have you, my friend. You're breaking news about the people in the Obama administration. I mean, the argument had been made that this Trans-Pacific Partnership, I have a different name for it, and I'm trying to get a, you know, maybe you can help me make this thing go viral. This is actually, you know, if the North American Free Trade Agreement is NAFTA and the Central American Free Trade Agreement is CAFTA, this is the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, also known as SHAFTA.
I think that's a very good euphemism for this deal, because it doesn't just this isn't just about trade. This is a Trojan horse for corporate deregulation, and it's not only going to hurt American workers, but it's going to take apart financial and corporate regulations in every country involved in this deal.
Right. So when we're, you know, and we've been talking about SHAFTA or TPP for some time, and the hit on it has been that it's being negotiated in secret and just corporations are doing it. But it turns out that actually there's a few people from the Obama administration who have been participating in these negotiations, and you've dug up some interesting little bits of information on who these folks are and the circumstances that are associated with their leaving private industry to negotiate on behalf of the Obama administration. First of all, do I have that right?
That's right. Two of the major officials tapped by the Obama administration to lead these negotiations, Michael Froman, the ambassador, the U.S. Trade Representative, and Stefan Selig, who hasn't been confirmed yet, but he's been tapped as the Undersecretary for International Trade at the Department of Commerce. Both of these individuals are former bankers, Froman from Citigroup and Selig from Bank of America. And what's interesting here is that both banks awarded these officials huge multi-million dollar bonuses as they were being tapped to work for the Obama administration. And this is important because it raises a significant conflict of interest, because this trade deal has huge ramifications for the big banks. Not only does this free up capital, but it also, as I mentioned, that the trade deal contains provisions that allow the banks to take entire governments to court to block regulations that they view as impacting their future profits.
Yeah. So basically, Obama has tapped a couple of corporate fat cats to negotiate the corporate fat cat deal, the new SHAFTA deal, and or TPP. And these guys, when they left their corporations, they got big bonuses or big chunks of cash. And presumably after the negotiations are over, whether they're successful or not, and certainly if they're successful, they will have a nice future ahead.
That's right. These bonuses are typically awarded right when an official leaves a bank or a major corporation, when they go into a regulatory or high-level government job. Some ethics experts call them remember me bonuses. And then once they do certain deeds in government that benefit their former employers, they swing back through the revolving door and receive another special bonus. In fact, Citigroup has a line in their executive contract that specifically says, if you leave the bank to join the government in a high-level position, you're entitled to a special bonus. So, again, this poses a significant conflict of interest, because Citigroup, in particular, is leading a coalition of corporations that are seeking big advantages in this trade deal.
Mm-hmm. Now, back during the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, there was rather famously, I think, I mean, I wrote about it in my book on equal protection. It was not a secret. It was in newspapers and things like that. There was a fellow at, as I recall, Monsanto, who left his job at Monsanto, became the regulator, approved the regulations, and then left the regulating position and went back to his job at Monsanto, living under the regulations that he himself had written. There was a fair amount of furor about that. Why has that revolving door not been closed? I mean, that was 30 years ago.
Well, I think one reason for that is that it's been normalized. It's not just the big banks. Northrop Grumman and other large companies have these special employment contracts that award these bonuses for their executives to burrow into government, to take these powerful jobs that then oversee their former employers, and then they go back into government. But I think this speaks to a larger problem of, one, the media, that most traditional media outlets, they don't focus on these issues. They're more interested in process stories or more tabloid-esque stories. And the other aspect of this problem is that the Department of Justice, the FBI, they haven't taken high-level corruption seriously. You'll see the Department of Justice go after mayors or state assemblymen for corruption, but they simply don't have the political will to investigate these crimes at the upper echelons.
Well, could that be because these same politicians are having their feathers, their nests of feathered, padded by, their campaign contributions, given to them, or their trips to Scotland or whatever, paid for by these large corporations?
Well, sure. I mean, there's a gift economy in D.C. that I'm sure you're aware of.
Yeah.
By living there, you see it all over the place. But there's a revolving door even at the Department of Justice. Look at Lanny Brewer, the chief of enforcement for the first 4 years of the Obama administration. He goes in, doesn't prosecute the big banks, doesn't prosecute upper-level political corruption, and then he goes back for a multi-million-dollar job at Covington & Burling, this big lobbying and law firm in D.C.
Whoa. And they don't have to wait like members of Congress for 2 years before they can start lobbying, do they? Or do they?
That's kind of the other big issue here. And I have a story coming out in The Nation tomorrow that actually looks into this. Lobbying law is simply not being enforced. You know, the letter of the law that you can't, that there's this cooling off period, that exists, but there's simply no enforcement. And how you actually define lobbying, are you making a contact, are you spending 20% of your time? There are so many loopholes written into it. Even if they were, even if officials were to enforce the law, it's very difficult.
So this is not unlike Karl Rove asserting that his 501c3 or C4, his so-called educational nonprofit, is educational because 51% of their money goes to educating the public and 49% goes to just overtly, nakedly political activity.
I think that's just the tip of the iceberg. But, yes, it's a similar dynamic where the IRS and some of these other oversight bodies create very vague standards, but then they don't even enforce their own rules.
So for those of us who would like to do something about this, I mean, outside of the obvious, you know, amending the Constitution so that we can no longer say that money is protected by the First Amendment or corporations by the 14th Amendment, what else can be done?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think a lot of campaign finance, good government experts have this debate. I'm a little bit, the kind of consensus right now is that we need better laws, that we need a new wave of reform, and I'm all for that. But I think what folks should be pushing for today, if you look back in American history, we've seen reform after investigations. We need a cop on the beat. We need the DOJ to investigate. We need Congress to convene a select committee that investigates political corruption. We need political will, and then we'll have reform.
It's time for the Church Commission all over again.
Yes.
Or the Church Committee, or whatever Frank Church did when he was the senator and he was investigating all that Nixon corruption. I'm with you. Lee Fong is the contributor to RepublicReport.org, The Nation Magazine, TheNation.com, and author of The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right, a brilliant book, which you must go out and buy. Lee, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Tom. Take care.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more right after this, 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And Ty, watching Free Speech TV in Atlanta, Georgia, on the DirecTV satellite network. Hey, Ty, welcome to the program.
How you doing, sir?
I'm fine. Thank you. I just want to say,
these Tea Party, man, they're crazy down here.
Oh, yeah?
I had some pamphlets that we'd go around to get to stand your ground, saying me and some Occupy friends, Mr. Eggerson is down here from Common Cause.
Mm-hmm.
And we were handing out the pamphlets. That guy put a pistol in my face and pulled a hammer back. And he was fixing. I shut my eyes. I just knew he was going to kill me. But they were waiting on us. They said that we ain't going to take their guns away. And they said we ain't going to come down there and do anything to any of their citizens like they said we did in St. Louis to that Kenneth Gladney guy.
Well,
they said that. You know, where they, Big J, Gladney guy, some people did, and the Tea Party stopped them. Now, here in the South, they kill you. They said, we're all behind each other. And so, anybody come down here, they better be watching out. And we got to do something with these folks.
Wow. That was in Stone Mountain?
Huh?
Was that in Stone Mountain? Where in Georgia? Was that in Atlanta? Where was it that you encountered
down
these Tea Partiers?
Down near the Capitol. Near Martin Luther King's church.
Oh, down in downtown Atlanta.
We've given out pamphlets down there, and we just happened to all be together there. And this black man, he's walking away, and I guess the guy thought we was doing something. And he told me, when I started handing him the paper, he put a pistol in my face and said, we don't take that down here. And
let me get this straight. You're a white progressive who is passing out literature saying, end the stand your ground, shoot first laws. Got that right?
Right.
Okay. And you were confronted by a group of white Tea Partiers, is that right?
Well, there was one black man, but there was most of them were white. And
yeah.
There was one man first, and then the other ones came up. And they said, if we want to do anything to anybody down here, you best they said something about having a, give us a hoodie. I think that's a ride on the front of a pickup truck.
Whoa.
And so they said we'd come down here and behave, but if we start messing, they said something about a hot dog man and about they got T-shirts. They said they're going to Kenneth Gladney. They're going to represent Kenneth Gladney or something like that because said they killing them up north. We ain't killing nobody up north.
Yeah.
But they said they ain't going to have that down here.
Boy, these guys are reading the right wing blogs, you know, and getting the right wing emails and things.
Well, one of these occupiers I had, it was with me. He told me about that Kenneth Gladney thing. They, you know, it's that town hall with a help thing. But I mean, I wasn't there. I didn't do nothing with it, you know.
Yeah, I don't know anything about that story. But then I, you know, generally I relegate the right wing spam to my spam filter rather than reading it. I guess I probably should read more of it. Just to keep up
well,
on.
Look at that Kenneth Gladney. It's definitely there. They beat him up. Tea Party stopped him, but they didn't use guns.
Yeah, Kenny Gladney.
Down here, they kill you.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Thank you, Ty, for the information. I'm gonna have to do a little search here on the DuckDuckGo machine and find out what the heck that's all about. Thanks. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, Tom Harbin here with you. Okay, this is back in 2011, July of 2011. It took a St. Louis County jury less than 50 minutes to return a not guilty verdict in the assault trial featuring Kenneth Gladney and two union members who were charged with attacking him outside a town hall event during the summer of 2009. Very interesting. It was on tape, and the Tea Party went nuts. Apparently, Tea Partier got attacked by a couple of union guys, and this has become the cause celeb. I just printed it out. I'm going to dig into it and learn a little bit more about it here. Interesting. We just had a caller call in and say that he was in Georgia, in Atlanta near the Capitol, passing out literature saying, you know, don't bring to Georgia or do away from Georgia the stand your ground, shoot first laws. And a bunch of Tea Partiers came up to him and said that they were going to hoodie him, you know, in other words, put him on the hood of the pickup truck and drive around, and threatened to kill him. And said, we're not going to have, you know, we're not going to be like Ken Gladley, who apparently was, you know, well, let me learn a little more. But the storyline, the right wing storyline, is Ken Gladley was a Tea Party guy who was assaulted by some union thugs. But I'll let you know more about it when I learn more about it. John in Vernon Hills, Illinois. Hey, John, what's up? Thanks for listening to WCPT. John, you are on the air.
Hi.
Hey.
This is John.
Yes, sir. You're on the air. What's up?
Yeah. It's the first time I've been able to talk to you, and I listen to you every day, and I've called in before and just left a message that I think you're the best talk radio host in the country, in the world, maybe even.
Well, thank you, John. So what's on your mind?
Well, you educate us very well, and what I was calling for is when you had Joe Madison on, and I believe Stand Your Ground is a racial driven law, and I think it is very similar to darn near the whole Republican Party with our black president. Let's block, 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 and stop, stop, stop anything we can.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't disagree. I think that there's a huge racial element both to the animus, the hatred shown toward President Obama by some on the right, and in fact, I would say many on the right, and I think that there's a huge racial component to the voter ID laws, and there's a huge racial component to the Stand Your Ground, Shoot First laws, and all of this has to do with the South rising again. And here's something to make it really, really ironic. In Arkansas, it takes a 75% supermajority of the state legislature to allow the state to take federal Medicare money, Medicaid money, to provide health care to poor people. 75% majority has to vote for that, and they may not be able to get that because they got some Tea Partiers down there in their legislature. But it only takes a 51% majority to declare that they're going to secede from the union and engage in a civil war against the United States. So you can see where their priorities are at. John, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. David at St. Paul in St. Paul, Nebraska. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's your Keystone people.
Mm-hmm.
We just got the breaking news that LB 1161 has been defeated. And they can no longer claim eminent domain to push that Keystone XL pipeline through Nebraska.
Oh, that's interesting. So LB 1161 would have been the legislative bill. It would have been a bill in the doesn't Nebraska have a unicameral legislature, just a single body?
Yes, we do.
Yeah, okay. So this was the piece of legislation that would have allowed eminent domain, the Fifth Amendment provision that allows government to take your property and reimburse you, but take your property for the public good, that would have allowed TransCanada, this private corporation out of Canada, to take your property and put the pipeline across it. Is that it? And it got defeated?
That's correct. Yeah, they declared it unconstitutional. But judge declared.
Oh, it was a judge.
Uh huh.
Very interesting. Okay, so the bill would have allowed it, and that got defeated. Now, didn't Nebraska was objecting to this thing, and there was some concerns about the aquifer and all this kind of thing. And I know that there was at least one state that the people planning the Keystone Pipeline rerouted the pipeline to avoid the problems with that state. Was that state Nebraska?
No, they have not.
So they were still planning on running it across Nebraska.
Yeah, they've always intended to run at some route.
Right.
There are existing pipeline routes to the east and down the river.
Right.
From the north, you know.
Yeah.
And but they didn't want to take those, you know, and they wanted to blast their way right through the center of the state.
Right.
Very
interesting. Well, I'm going to have to track this down. Dave, thanks for the heads up on that. I do appreciate it. I'm telling you, we got the smartest, most well-informed listeners of any radio show on or TV show, all of the above. In America. I am so impressed with y'all. Diane in San Jose, California. Diane, we have just 1 minute to the break. It's all yours.
Oh, okay. Hi, Tom. I want you to know that I can really understand how some white people are afraid of black teenagers. And just quickly, I'm going to try to go real fast. A friend of mine worked at Skyline Boulevard, Skyline School in Oakland. He was telling me terrible things about how the teachers were beaten up, and even the security guard, who was black, said, this is terrible, you know. And I couldn't even believe it. It was so bad. He got jumped from behind. And I think some of these things that...
Yeah, but that doesn't, you know, that's not necessarily a comment on black people, Diane. I mean, there are black gangs. There are black people who are violent. There are Hispanic gangs. There are Hispanic people who are violent.
Oh,
there are
no,
white gangs. There are white people who are violent.
Hey, listen, I wanted to tell you quickly. Yeah, I'm Mexican and Middle Eastern. And whenever I talk about some of the gangs in San Jose, people want to shut me up.
Yeah.
I don't want them to kill each other.
Yeah.
You know, but there's been, I'm sure you heard about the gangs in San Jose. Real dangerous, Tom. So I'm saying.
Yeah. No, and this is what drives this is the war on drugs and poverty. Diane, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The answer isn't for all of us to be afraid of people of color or white guys who are skinheads or whatever. All of these things are manifestations of poverty, the war on drugs, and insane trade policy. The bad and the very, very macaronically ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine.com. The good, Volkswagen. Although the car company's plan to create a European-style works council in Chattanooga, Tennessee, hit a roadblock when workers voted down a United Auto Workers unionization drive last Friday, they're not giving up just yet. Frank Fisher, the head of the Chattanooga plant, said in an email to Bloomberg that, quote, our goal continues to be to determine the best method for establishing a works council, end quote. In other words, Volkswagen, the company, actually wants its workers to join a union. If only more American companies thought like that. The bad. Gail Finney, Kansas State Representative, is a big fan of spanking. In fact, she's such a big fan of spanking that she's introduced a bill into the Kansas State Legislature that would let teachers forcefully spank misbehaving students. Kansas already allows teachers to spank students, but Finney's bill would expand that power, allowing, quote, up to 10 forceful applications in succession of a bare open-hand palm against the clothed buttocks of a child, hard enough that redness or bruising may occur on the tender skin of a child as a result, end of quote. Because, you know, beating a student with an open hand makes corporal punishment so much more civilized. And the very, very ugly racist Ole Miss vandals. The University of Mississippi is doing some deep soul searching this week after an on-campus statue of civil rights leader James Meredith, the college's first black student, was found draped in a noose. University police discovered the defaced statue Sunday morning after responding to a call about a vandalism incident. They also found at the scene a pre-2003 Georgia State flag, a flag emblazoned with the Confederate stars and bars. Police aren't sure whether the vandals in question were students or locals, but in the end, it doesn't really matter. Draping the statue of an African-American in a noose and a Confederate-style flag is just about one of the most offensive things you can do. And that is very, very ugly.
That's mind-bogglingly ugly.
So, Suho in Gowanda, New York. You had a comment on the economy, sir?
Hello. Thank you for taking my phone. This is the first time I ever talked with. I happened to have your book last night, and it's very strange because I got this book 2002, 12 years ago, The Last Hours of Asian Sunlight.
Right.
Waking up to personal and global transformation.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to propose to you that I'd like to have a radical spiritual conference in Washington, D.C. with your book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, and you as a keynote speaker.
Well, thank you.
I think we need something conference together, and I happened to watch this free speech today, and I'm so glad I have a chance to talk to you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Is that what you wanted to say? That's what you wanted to talk about?
Yes, in okay. The conference, you can talk about economy or...
Okay. Well, I have that conference out of Washington, D.C. every day for 4 hours. We do 3 hours here on the radio and an hour on television in the evening, and 5 days a week. And let me add, if you put together a conference and invite me to speak, contact my wife. Her contact information is on our website. She keeps our calendar. But I do those things from time to time. My schedule's pretty insane, but... when I can, I do. So, Suhu, thank you very much for the call. Thank you for your kind words. Thanks for reading the book. I wish you the very best of luck in putting something together. I would love to show up. Tracy in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Tracy, you talked to Jeff Sessions?
Yeah, and I used to live in Alabama for 2 years, but when George Bush Jr. was still president, I got on C-SPAN and told Jeff Sessions, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United Corporations of America and to the lobbyists for which they stand, one greedy group of politicians rejected by God, indisputable with tyranny and injustice for all.
Wow.
And then I told him, I said, why don't you go back to K Street and tell all your little friends what I just told you?
And what did he say?
Nothing.
Yeah.
He's one of the more docile of the group.
Yeah. Yeah, Jeff Sessions is not a he's not a firebrand. He's just a shill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't targeting him. He just happened to be the person from that town, you know. I did sue my mortgage lender. I'm not allowed to say who they are. I got I fought against two lawyers, and I am not a lawyer, and it took me 2.5 years, and I got the judge ruled in my favor, and I got a substantial amount of money. I've been in my home since 2003. I was there for 10 years. It was a historic home, 1885, and it was just hard. You know, I'm not a lawyer, so it was very difficult, but.
Yeah, well, good on you for prevailing, Tracy. That's.
Well, you know what? When you get mad and the other people around you are also getting mad, I couldn't even find any lawyers in the Kansas City phone book, mortgage lawyers. They said to me sometimes, the few that answered the phone, I said, these banks are too big. We just can't. We just don't aren't able to fight them.
So, did you win based on? Did you win based on the fact that their paperwork? You know, because so many of these banks have lost the paperwork on their mortgages or never got things originally signed. Was that the device that you used?
No, I wasn't on that because I had a regular mortgage. I never do variable rates and.
So what did you win based on?
That I forget what the thing is called, but it was I'm trying to think of what it was. Promissory estoppel.
Mm-hmm.
And so the judge went into I've never seen the judge, but in just St. Joe. They had a thing with the telephone company and somebody else, and they just kept saying that this thing that you signed to get a new modification or whatever it is,
right.
And you it just rolled on and on and on, and they would they lied about everything. You know,
wow.
If you sent documents in, they'd say, well, you didn't send your documents in. You know, and it was just a nightmare. This happened to people all over the country, and just that one. Thing that I was in.
Remarkable. Tracy, thank you. I've got to move along. We've got a bunch of other callers here, but thank you for your comments and good luck on or congratulations. Now I've got to figure out what a promissory estoppel is. But Nate in Denver, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Nate, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks. I always so appreciate your show, too. But
thank you.
On this pipeline.
Keystone XL.
The XL pipeline. I don't see any way, if you were to argue that we need to leave the world a better place for our kids, right? And so you could say, well, let's get the oil out of the ground. Or, you know, 100 years ago, the dollar was worth a fair amount, and today it's worth a lot less, okay? Oil was nothing, and today it's worth a small fortune. 100 years from now, the dollar is going to be worth less than it is today, you know, and oil is going to be worth an absolute fortune, or any kind of carbon, right?
Well, that's assuming that 100 years from today we have a civilization that we can call the United States. I mean, if the climate change predictions come true, 100 years from today we may all be living tribally if we're living at all.
Right, but that's just another reason not to get this oil out of the ground. I mean,
right.
Especially that nasty crap up there.
Yep.
And for 1,000 jobs, I mean, people. I mean, we're smoking marijuana in Colorado, but people, I mean, you all need to quit this stuff.
Yeah, I got you, Nate. Well said. Thanks a lot for the call. Randy in Volcano, California. Hey, Randy, you wanted to talk about Keystone, too?
Yes, I did, Tom, and thanks for having me.
Thank you.
I'm curious if you know or one of your listeners where the pipe for this supposedly Keystone pipeline is going to be manufactured.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, you know, the Bay Bridge was made in China. So the question is the pipe coming from China or someplace like that, or is it going to be made here in the United States, or is it going to be made in Canada since this is a Canadian company that's building it? I don't know the answer to that. That's a damn good question. Guessing that, you know, one of the folks in our chat room or one of our listeners or viewers will be able to figure this out and let us know, and maybe we can track it down as well. But it's you don't know the answer to the question, Randy.
Well, I have a few other questions regarding the pipeline. Also,
okay, we got about 10 seconds here.
Okay, I worked in construction all my life. Isn't there a safer way to build a pipeline nowadays, like oil leak detectors, valves more often where you could shut it off?
Double-lined
pipe, they do that.
Yes, but it is more expensive, and so they're choosing not to do that. And in fact, the federal government suggested detectors every certain distance, and Keystone said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to go with them a much greater distance. I'm sorry, I don't remember right off the top of my head what the amounts were, but, you know, we did a show on this 6-8 months ago. Randy, thank you for the call. Keystone is nasty stuff. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
There are times when you simply say, let's just leave this carbon in the ground for the sake of future generations. And now is the time to say it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Michael in Clayton, North Carolina. Michael, you wanted to... Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You wanted to talk about a Facebook post?
Yes, Tom. I just wanted to say that racism is alive and well in the South.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yesterday on Facebook, one of my friends posted a video entitled Obama Army Black Thugs Attack Whites.
Whoa.
I responded to my friend that there could only be one reason to share this video. I traced the video to its source and reported it to Facebook. Today it is gone.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to also tell you that the Georgia Department of Revenue is offering a new license plate. With Georgia and the background of the Confederate flag, and then the Confederate flag saying Sons of Confederate Veterans 1896, and then in gold, where the county normally would be, it says Sons of Confederate Veterans.
Mm.
Now, these are not just rednecks or white trash. They are educated people that I know.
Yeah.
And I just cannot understand them. We grew up in the segregated South. We should know better.
You would think. On the other hand, if your ancestors participated in an historic event, even if they were on the wrong side of history, and particularly, you know, if there was a huge price to be paid, and there was for much of the South, shouldn't we just allow them to be to be proud of the fact that there was that happened, or is it just such a shameful event in your mind that I know the Stars and Bars, the battle flag of the Confederacy, was taken off the Georgia flag back in 2003, but you know, it's still, I think it's still in one of the Carolinas.
I think they're, yes, you're right, South Carolina.
Yeah. So isn't there a point where, or is there? I mean, I'm asking the question. I could argue either side of this. Either, you know, it's time for us to get over it and say, you know, this was a horrible period in American history, but you know, from the point of view of the South, it was the Northern War of Aggression. You know, the banks were basically trying to blow up the Southern economy. At least that's the story that they told my kids when they went to public school in Georgia. And you know, of course, from the point of view of the North, it was the South trying to hang on to the last vestiges of slavery, which they thought was going to be taken, ended in 1808, according to the Constitution.
Yes.
So
the selling of slaves was ended.
The importation of slaves was ended in 1808, not the sale of them.
Not the sale, right.
Yeah.
She had children.
Yep. So...
Tom, I am a history political science major, and I've continued to study my entire life about these subjects. And
right.
I read your book, The Crisis 2016.
Yeah.
And no, I do not look at this license plate as some kind of pride in the Confederacy.
Mm.
The timing of it and what's going on in the South is this will create... hatred.
Yeah, more division. And so this is part of the gestalt of the Southern reaction to a black man in the White House. Is that your opinion?
Yes. They will never say that.
Yeah. Well, actually, some of them have. But, yeah, no, I get it. The vast majority of them won't. Michael, thank you for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Let's check in with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by the goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give a gift of a goat to a returning slave in South Sudan. And Ellen, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. If all holds, I will be going on March 1st, but that's always a fluid situation.
Yeah, I just heard that there's a new front that broke out in the wars in South Sudan just
not
yesterday.
Not far from us.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
A little, but you know, I mean...
Yeah.
Abye might as well be in California, even though it's 70 miles from where you and I were, because there's no roads. So,
yeah. But it's still only 70 miles.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about, speaking only 70, is Ukraine. Now, as you know, there has been a lot of talk about sanctions. The president today issued a statement as he was leaving to Mexico about possibility of sanctions.
Against who?
Against the government of Ukraine, both in terms of trade, in terms of allowing them to travel anywhere, all of that. As you know, there's been a lot of protests. There's been deaths, et cetera. And as you have said, this could easily turn into World War III if people aren't careful. Well,
that's my concern.
I was going to give a whole long thing about it today, and I cannot guarantee that this is accurate, but we just literally 5 minutes ago got on Twitter saying that they had settled it, that the government was going to be listening to the protesters and that they were going to dialogue. Now, again, that came on Twitter, so I can't tell you whether it's true or not. It has definitely not hit the news services as of the time I'm broadcasting this with you, but I expect that the European Union was going to be meeting on this coming Thursday on it, and so I think that for whatever reason they decided to pull it together.
Was this tweet said in the name of Yanukovych?
No, it was not from him. It was just from some random news agency that we subscribe to there.
Huh.
So, again, I don't know about that, but my guess is when you have the European Union at you and you've got on one side and you have Vladimir Putin and then the Russians on the other side, you're going to say, better time to at least talk.
Yeah, yeah. Seems like a reasonable
Very reasonable. Okay. Now, the FCC and net neutrality, this is the issue of charging more money for certain sites, therefore cutting off access to
one
people.
One of our employees, one of the people who works here, I don't know if this person wants to be named or not, so I'm not, but has Verizon Fios. And just over the last week, they have noticed that when they try to watch movies on Netflix, it just doesn't come down. And they're paying for the super fast stuff. I pay for the super fast stuff at home. I have Comcast. And when I use a virtual private network, you know, to try to just, you know, have some confidentiality and so that they can't read the content of what I'm sending and receiving or where I'm going, they slow me to zero. It's like this is all happening.
It's like all happening,
exactly.
So basically, the court said they can't do this. This was about 4 to 6 months ago. And now the FCC is issuing its own rules, again, because the court did say, well, the FCC could regulate the Internet.
Right.
Can't have it both ways. But it looks like the FCC, because of the public, is trying to come down on the side of net neutrality.
So they're doing that by defining the Internet service providers as utilities.
I don't know exactly the wording, but whatever.
Or as common carriers,
yes,
one or the other?
I think common carriers. I think that is sort of how it's being done. Now, what does that mean if the FCC regulates it? You know, a lot of people that we know well don't use certain words that you don't use on radio, on the Internet. Does that mean that they're going to stop that?
I mean, like the old, it used to be on the phone. Yeah, when you and I were kids, you couldn't swear on the telephone because it was illegal. Although
right.
I think nobody really took that seriously.
Well, exactly. Well, I used to, in the 1970s, I lived in Harvard, Massachusetts, not Harvard University, way out in Harvard, Massachusetts, and we had essentially a party line for long distance.
So you couldn't swear on the phone.
No, you could not swear on the phone.
Because people might be listening.
Now, also, California today announced that they have reached their goals for the month on the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare, and that they had people sign up by the end of January, 728,000 people, 410 people had signed up, and it also looked like people were actually paying. 80% of the enrollees had paid for their first month. So California is very, very happy with what they are having in terms of their sign up.
That's marvelous.
That is marvelous.
Any idea what percentage of that is Medicaid versus fully paid?
There's no. In addition to that, another 877 are eligible for Medicaid. So
877,000.
That's right. So there's another 877,000 that are in addition to that number that's eligible for Medicaid.
Whoa.
Yeah, so
that's pretty good.
That's actually quite good. Okay, so the president was asked via Jay Carney today about immigration and the summit that's going on, the Three Amigos summit that's going on in Mexico, and they said that 2014 they think is the best opportunity to get immigration done. They said that the Republican leaders are recognizing the value of immigration reform. It's called money. And to broader security, whatever that means. But that's the White House speak for we're going to try and get this immigration bill done.
Do you think that it's possible that this might, you know, that Mitch McConnell is hanging on by his fingernails? John Boehner, the rumors are that he's going to retire. If both of these guys were just to conclude, you know, the Tea Party's made this party crazy, time to retire, I'm getting out of here, let's do what's right for the country. Do you think there's any possibility that that would be the story of the next 7 or 8 months until the November elections?
Well, that would certainly garner another Profiles in Courage book.
And in
some degree, Boehner did take on his party on the debt ceiling.
Right. So did McConnell.
And you know,
he
they didn't honestly
Cruz.
Get enough credit for that because they basically said to the Tea Party.
Yeah. And then Ted Cruz tried to blow up the Republican Party and McConnell.
Well, he's desperate to run for president as the Tea Party candidate. I've ever seen.
And he's in competition with Rand Paul for that.
Right.
Which is very strange. What else is there?
On NAFTA, because, you know, I call it NAFTA shift.
The TPP is the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement. So
right.
That is SHAFTA.
Right. And they are now talking that NAFTA was a success. Do you know it's going to be 20 years since the passing of NAFTA? I remember the night it was passed. They had a big party at the White House.
Wow. Yeah. I remember when it was passed.
I wasn't invited.
You weren't invited. I wasn't anywhere near Washington, D.C. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And as I mentioned a couple hours ago, this things in Ukraine are heating up. Ellen Radner was with us with a Talk Radio News report just a few minutes ago, and she said that there might be breaking news, that there is some sort of a resolution going on in Ukraine. But I really wanted to dig into this with somebody who really understands this stuff and understands it at a level and with a depth that most of us have nothing close to. Stephen Cohen is with us. He's a contributing editor to The Nation. He's professor emeritus of Russian studies and politics at NYU and Princeton. And his book, which examines the new Cold War and is now available in paperback, is titled Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives. And of course, The Nation is thenation.com. And Professor Cohen, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. It's great talking with you. We've talked on television. I think this might be the first time you've been on our radio program.
It is, yeah.
First of all, I think progress. Hayes Brown wrote a piece just hours ago. This was at 1 o'clock this afternoon. Vladimir Putin's terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. And it speaks rather poorly of Mr. Putin. What's going on in Ukraine? What's the backstory of this? And let's start with that. Give us a Ukraine 101.
I published a few days ago, it's the cover story of The Nation, excuse me, Tom, an article called Media Distortions, Distorting Russia, Putin, Sochi, Ukraine. What I argued is that for 20 years, the media, the American media narrative, the mainstream narrative that we've gotten of Russia has been badly distorted. Why that's so could be a separate issue, but it's come to bear now on Putin personally, Ukraine, and certainly the run-up to Sochi. If we start at the beginning with Ukraine, because I think this is potentially a historic event we're watching unfold in Ukraine. Let me get to the punchline. It's possible that the end result will be a new Cold War divide in Europe for generations, whether Ukraine is partitioned into two states or just remains in a kind of insipid political civil war. But a Cold War divide in Europe that is not, as was the 45-year Cold War, far away in Berlin, but right on Russia's borders, and right through the very heart of Russia's historical, political, cultural, religious civilization. And that would mean instability and the potential of war for, I'm older than you, Tom, our kids and my grandkids. So this could be really something historic that we're witnessing. But let's flash back to how this began. It began 400 years ago, but the reality is, and this is not addressed by the American media in any focused way, there is no the Ukraine. There is no the Ukrainian people.
though that's the way the media tells the story. The Ukrainian people and the Ukraine are yearning to escape the thug Putin's Russia to the democratic and prosperous Western Europe. The reality is, at a minimum, there are two Ukraines, one in the West, which does indeed yearn to join Europe, or at least Poland and Lithuania. We'll see what they find if they get there, and mainly in eastern, but to a certain extent, southern Ukraine, a budding Russia, a people, Ukrainians, who are ethnically, linguistically, religiously, politically, historically, culturally, and by millions of mixed marriages with Russians, who want to remain with Russia politically and economically. So now flash to the beginning of the current story. Excuse me, I'm fighting a cold of all this crazy weather.
It's quite all right.
In November, the European Union, the EU, said to who is, after all, the democratically elected president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, though we're told to hate him very much, but he was elected, you must choose now between an economic affiliation with the EU or one with Russia. So the real culprit, if we're asking how this horrible scene we're witnessing, I mean, Kiev is burning, I mean, dozens of people are dead, hundreds are wounded, it could be much worse. If you want to ask who pulled the trigger in the short run, it wasn't Putin. It wasn't Viktor Yanukovych, the president of Ukraine. That's the media narrative. It was the EU's ultimatum to the democratically elected president of a profoundly divided country. Now, at that moment, I know I'm going on too long, but this is the context. At that moment in November, December, Putin said, wait a minute, guys, why does Ukraine have to choose? How about a tripartite arrangement, he called it, whereby both Russia and the European Union will financially help Ukraine get out of its terrible economic crisis, because Ukraine was then, 3 months ago, remains today, on the verge of financial collapse, can't pay its debts, it's going to default. It's going to be horrible pain for the Ukrainian people. Putin's offer for a three-way arrangement was flatly rejected by Washington and Brussels. Now,
why?
Well, you want to ask why now, or you want to wait?
That's okay, yeah. Pardon my interrupting.
The point is, the pro-Western Ukrainians, when Yanukovych did reject the EU's offer and accepted instead the $15 billion loan Putin offered, that brought the protesters into the street. Now, remember one thing. So far as we know, he might have secretly, Yanukovych has signed no long-term agreements with Russia. He just took the $15 billion, which Ukraine desperately needed. What did the EU offer? Because to a certain extent, it was a bidding war. I mean, it was like purchasing a used car. Everybody was raising, or at a tobacco auction where I grew up in Kentucky. I used to love to go to tobacco auctions, you know, where you raised your hand or shouted out your bid. The EU offered €800 million, and Russia offered $15 billion.
All right, so the EU offered a little over $1 billion.
It was no-brainer. It was no-brainer. So that got the people in the streets, and from there it's gone from bad to worse with all sorts of unsavory people. I would call them quasi-fascist, now playing a role. So that's how we got where we are today. Now, if you want to ask why Washington and Brussels rejected the Putin's offer of a three-way agreement, that will take us into heresy that's not permitted in America. If you want to join me, I'll be happy to tell you.
Yes, we have about a minute and a half before the break.
I can do it in 30 seconds.
Cool.
After the Soviet Union ended, the West, led by the U.S., began a march toward post-Soviet Russia. It began with the expansion of NATO under Clinton. It continued under Bush. It continued under Obama. It's featured not only NATO expansion, but missile defense on Russia's border, a military outpost in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, and now the West is at the gates of Ukraine. End of story. Or first chapter, sorry.
Whoa. So this is about the expansion of empire in a way, is it not?
I don't ever use the word empire. I mean, because I want to win over people who don't like that kind of language. But we could say it's a good policy that Russia's a rotten country and we should do everything we can to weaken it, encircle it, even take it over. I think it's reckless, brought us to a new Cold War. And
they've got nukes.
They got everything, you know. They got more weapons of mass destruction than anybody, not only nukes, but chemical, biological, the whole kit and caboodle. So this has been a reckless bipartisan policy. Democrats, Republicans, progressives, I mean, they bang this drum on MSNBC, too.
Right.
So what am I to say? There are five or six of us of strange political coloration in the United States protesting, and we can speak out on a handful of programs, including yours.
We're talking with Dr. Stephen Cohen, contributing editor to The Nation, professor emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at New York University, NYU, and Princeton. He writes for The Nation, thenation.com, and his most recent book is now out in paperback. It's titled Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, which examines the new Cold War. We'll be back with more, Dr. Cohen, and your calls for him, should you have questions, right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
What is actually going on in Ukraine? What does it have to do with Russia? What does it have to do with us? And could this be the beginning of a world war? Welcome back. Dr. Cohen, you're still with us?
I am, and you don't have to call me doctor.
Okay. Well, I try
to... I do not make house calls.
Okay. Stephen, yeah. Mr. Cohen.
Steve will be fine.
Steve, okay, thank you. Our commercial stations have gone to break. We are with our Free Speech TV audience and our Pacifica audience, which are not insignificant, although anything you say of great importance in the next 4 minutes, I will probably ask you to repeat very, very briefly when our commercial stations rejoin us. You mentioned that it is a collection. You are one of four or five or six voices, seven voices in America who are addressing, who are heretics to the orthodoxy, I guess. My phrase is not yours, but...
No, that's my phrase. I'd accept that. There's okay. Orthodoxy, which is the mainstream view of Russia and our policy, and there are a few heretics running around.
Yeah. And why is that?
I don't know, because, look, I've been around a long time, Tom. I entered academic life as a professor in the early 70s and rather quickly became I got into the mass media, writing for op-ed pages, being on TV. In the 70s and 80s, the dispute was between people who thought we needed more Cold War with Soviet Russia, and we needed something called detente,
right,
which was reducing conflict. And that was American democracy at work.
And that was Nixon, Kissinger, wasn't it, detente?
Lots of people. I mean, I began with Eisenhower, and Carter had a position. But here's the point. There were loud, articulate, and politically powerful voices on both sides. I was on the detente side, but we had senators who supported us. We had people who ran for president. The New York Times, the Washington Post called up and said, you want to be on our op-ed page opposing somebody who disagrees with you? And we said, yes. Today that's ended. There's one hand clapping, and that's this triumphalist winner-take-all American policy toward post-Soviet Russia, which the mainstream media has followed. Now, why there's not more opposition to it, I'm not sure. One reason is we've been deluded into thinking that when the Soviet Union ended, all our existential dangers ended with it. We know that's not so. We were even told nuclear war is now impossible. We now know that's not so, or why would the United States be spending trillions of dollars on missile defense? But there was something, I think, that entered our bloodstream. We were the indispensable, triumphant, virtuous nation, and here's the key phrase, the only superpower. That kicked in about 1991, 1992, about 25 years ago. So we've raised a whole generation of Americans, including my 22-year-old daughter, on that false narrative of American history. And where is Russia in that? Well, Russia is in there, at least it was in the 90s, when there was a supplicant Russian president, Boris Yeltsin, in the position that Japan and Germany were in after World War II.
Right.
That is, okay, we beat you, and you were bad, but now we will help you become good, and here's how it's going to happen at home. And by the way, in international affairs, please carry our spears. Well, that's what we tried to do with Russia in the 1990s, and a handful of us, including the late George Kennan, the great American thinker about U.S.-Russian relations, lived into his hundreds, died a few years ago, he said, you're creating a backlash in Russia.
Right.
And the name of that backlash is Vladimir Putin.
Well, yeah. Boy, he was prophetic. Dr. Stephen Cohen is with us. We'll be back with more. And I have some questions. We'll pick up your questions for Dr. Cohen. He's with us for the hour. Stick around. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. Stephen Cohen is with us. He is a contributing editor to The Nation, professor emeritus of Russian studies and politics at NYU and Princeton. And his book, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, which examines this new Cold War, is now available in paperback. Steve, just to kind of recap and a question. In fact, a conspiracy theory I'd like to run by you. You mentioned that the American consensus basically since the early 90s, since the fall of the Soviet Union, has been that there's only one superpower in the world. It's us. We're triumphalist. Unlike Germany and Japan, we beat them, and now they're buddies with us. Russia, we beat them in the Cold War, but they're not so much buddies with us. That we used to have, you know, two sides of this argument. There was the detente side that said, let's be collaborative even with the Soviet Union and or the Russians. And then there was the let's have a Cold War side. And now it's all Cold War rhetoric, both on the right and the left. Could it be? First of all, have I accurately characterized?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. I think that's a rough approximation of our landscape today.
Could it? And the question that both of us were asking kind of out loud is, why is it that there is no honest debate in the American media or in the American body politic? You don't have a single senator standing up saying, wait a minute, how about detente with Putin? Could it be that there's no money to be made? I mean, we're in the middle of a very, very deeply connected economic relationship with both Germany and Japan. We are not with Russia. And the only way that we can make money with regard to Russia, to the extent that our politics in America are driven by money, the only way we can make money with them is to arm up against them. Does that make any sense?
Well, it's, as Russians like to say, this is a favorite Russian expression, it's a theory that has the right to exist and ought to be discussed. But let me tell you one of the counter, or maybe it's not a counter argument, it's this. Back in the 70s and 80s, when the pro-détente movement was strong enough to field candidates, we had a grassroots movement, which was called the Stop the Nukes, Anti-Nuke Movement. There were a lot of grassroots folks involved in trying to cut back on the nuclear arms race or end it altogether. That movement is, I don't want to say it's gone, because I know good folks are out there, but it's no longer a factor in American national politics. The people who were a factor in favor of détente, and this goes to your point, were corporate executives who wanted to do business with Soviet Russia. I'll name you some names. Donald Kendall, who was head of PepsiCo, wanted to beat Coca-Cola in the Soviet Russia.
Sure.
Tom Watson, head of IBM, wanted to be the person that flooded Russia with computers. We had a pro-détente organization. It was called the American Committee for East-West Accord. It had a lot of eminent people. Eminent means old. Some younger ones, as I was then. But Kendall and Watson were on our board, and they paid for the offices. They funded this. In other words, they understood that Cold War political relations was screwing up their business. Now, you would think today, when you have even more American corporations who want to tap into what is a vast Russian growing middle-class market, everything from Taco Bell and McDonald's to American movies and Gap clothwear, everybody wants to get there, not to mention cars and oil and nickel and all this, these natural resources. You would think that corporate executives today would be on our side. So the question in my mind is, because it's bad for their business, I'm giving you the counter argument to what you're saying, why aren't they? Why aren't they saying to the presidents to whom they have access and the secretaries of state, hey, this is crazy. What is this crazy Magnitsky law that Congress published that really was humiliating? And why isn't Obama going to Sochi? After all, Putin saved him from humiliation in August when he got Assad to give up his chemical weapons. And unless the president or the vice president or the secretary of state goes to Moscow in a politically at least neutral way and advocates trade relations, we're giving all the business to Germany and China and Italy.
We're a small player in the Russian economic market. So I don't know, Tom. I'm looking in my own mind for something more psychological and political.
Hmm.
Why? And by the way, I'm going to be absolutely candid. There's a lack of civic courage. I know congresspeople who read what I write or hear me or call me and say, you know, I couldn't agree with you more. And I say, great, I'll be looking forward to your speech on the floor of the House or some press conference.
Crickets.
And they
right.
don't say anything. And I, you know what? I think they may think that the American people will turn against him. But I grew up in Kentucky, was educated in Indiana, lived in Florida, taught in New Jersey, live in New York. I've never run into masses of American people who want to smite the Russians. This is a disease of our American political class.
Well, and China, I mean, was the great boogeyman of my generation as a young person. You know, China is going to flip the dominoes of Southeast Asia, and we've got to stand against them in Vietnam.
Right.
And, boy, are we in bed with China right now. And they're still,
I don't think you're that old to remember China and Vietnam, Tom. That's something you read, I think.
Yeah. In my dreams.
I do remember that, Will, and you're 100% right. Look, let me give you a hypothetical, and let me give you a piece of news that you might not know. Maybe, because he's toxic otherwise to a lot of us, but maybe, one of the most outspoken voices protesting this craziness in America toward Putin has been Patrick Buchanan.
Hmm.
Buchanan has said that Putin's our partner, that's what I say, that we need to make him our partner to make the world safe. Now, Putin has a sidebar, Buchanan. About 2 years ago, Putin began calling himself a conservative. And in these 2 years, he's given a series of public speeches defining his conservatism as basically traditional family values plus stability, plus sovereignty.
Plus nationalism.
Yeah. Right, plus nationalism.
Which is Pat Buchanan's agenda.
Yeah, right. And there's an anti-gay agenda buried in here. Well, Pat fell in love with this.
Yeah.
And I think if you asked him who would be the ideal president of the United States, he'd nominate Putin. But the point is, you're getting a few people around the spectrum, marginalized, who do see, though, that for our national security, what we want Obama to do is embrace Putin's, at least in international affairs.
Hang on just a second, Steve.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We are talking with Stephen Cohen, contributing editor with The Nation, author of the book Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives. We'll be back in 6 minutes with more of Dr. Cohen. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, broadcasting on commercial stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as TV on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide. With us is Dr. Stephen Cohen, or Professor Stephen Cohen, Steve Cohen, the contributing editor to The Nation, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at NYU in Princeton. The author of the book Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, which examines the new Cold War and is now available in paperback. And most recently, the cover story of the March 3rd edition of The Nation magazine and this brilliant article, Distorting Russia, How the American Media Misrepresents Putin, Sochi, and Ukraine. Steve, you're still with us?
I'm here.
Okay. I've got a bunch of people who have questions for you on the phone. Before we get to those, do you want to quickly summarize, or is there anything you wanted to add to the things that you said up to this point?
Just want to say that the article you mentioned has won me some new friends and lots of new enemies. And the argument of the enemies of the article is, and I'll summarize Charles Krafthammer on the Bill O'Reilly show, Cohen likes Putin better than he likes America. In other words, that's to shut down a discussion that I'm not a patriot.
Right.
And that there's no need to discuss the issues I raise about policy and media coverage. And the short answer to this is that a real patriot is deeply worried about American national security. And a real patriot understands that we need allies to help face the dangers, and that Russia is the one that could be the most valuable. So it's people like Krafthammer who are not the patriots, because they're engaged in some polemical ideological war that should have ended 40 years ago. And they blind us and they blind the country to the imminent dangers. And so it's very hard to get this conversation focused on the issues amid all this name-calling. And I've seen it before, but it is discouraging.
Yeah. In a way, it's just a repeat of the rhetoric that we heard against Etat 40 years ago.
It is.
Yeah. Okay, let's pick up some calls here. Rick, in Port Royal, Pennsylvania. Rick, you're on the air with Stephen Cohen.
Hello, Professor. I have in front of me a book. It was originally titled The Belarus Secret. It's by John L. Loftus. He brought it out in 2010, revised, titled America's Nazi Secret. He describes how we brought these war criminals home secretly, the Department of Justice. We hid them, and we're going to use them for future use, parachute them into these countries when the opportunities are right. I know that's long past, but I think, do you think that they're scratching that old itch?
It's a good question, Rick, and I know the history you're talking about, and it is true that we brought Nazi intelligence agents and Nazi nuclear scientists to help us fight the Soviet Union after World War II. It was an ugly episode. The itches may still be there, but here's my reaction in terms of current events. Let's say there have been, I don't know the numbers now, there are tens of thousands in the streets of Ukraine. In November, December, it was hundreds of thousands. Overwhelmingly, these are decent people. These are honorable, democratic, liberal-minded people who just want to be part of Europe. And that's their right. That's what history created. But there has emerged a smaller group, maybe 5, 10%, who are ultra-nationalist to the extent that they are quasi-fascist. Fascism has a long history in Ukraine. Many Ukrainians fought with the Nazis in the destruction of Russians and Jews and others in Ukraine in World War II. These people are small in number, let's say 5%, but they're very well organized. They're armed. They're funded. They, unlike most of the politicians, know exactly what they want, and they dislike Europe and America every bit as much as they dislike Russia. What I don't understand is why the American media hasn't brought the attention of reading Americans and the American political elite to this growing danger. They are the ones who are throwing Molotov cocktails, that is, glass bottles filled with kerosene with a lit rag in it, at police and rocks and steel bars. That kind of behavior would not be tolerated in any Western democracy. It would be shut down immediately. And yet, the impulse behind it, this ultra-nationalist, quasi-fascist impulse, is either not mentioned or dismissed as marginal. But we know from history that a small group can have an enormous political impact when everybody else is confused and uncertain about what to do. So I think this is a grave danger, and fascism has raised its head across Europe, largely in reaction to the austerity policies of the EU governments, and it's now visible in Ukraine, and I think it's grave, grave, grave danger.
I mentioned in the tease at the very beginning of the hour, could this be World War III or something to that effect? We've got callers from Kansas and Colorado, Illinois, New York, and Alabama, and other places that want to talk to you, but just, I have to get this question in. Moderator's privilege, I guess. Is it possible that we're looking in Ukraine at something that is not dissimilar from what we saw in 1914 in Sarajevo when Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated and suddenly the world was plunged into World War I, and to this day nobody can really explain why?
I don't know, Tom. I mean, I have this policy of what I don't know, I say I don't know. I understand that analogy, and because we're at the 100th anniversary of World War I, people have been talking about it. I think there are at least two differences, though. We know, or at least I think I know, the cause of this crisis in Ukraine. I mentioned it before. It's the U.S.-led Western march on post-Soviet Russia for the last 25 years, and they're at the gates of Kiev now. It's a long process. The other thing is, let's say the world had to choose. This is a kind of silly or frivolous hypothetical, but let's say the world had to choose between, to put it crudely, Obama and Putin. We present Putin in this country as a marginal evil figure in world affairs, but the fact is he has admirers in many, many, many populist countries, beginning in China, in India, in many countries where, whether we like it or not, you and I, because we're progressive guys, but where what we call progressive social policies are hated in those countries, where women don't have equality, gays don't have equality. This is, I think, numerically the majority of the world's population. And were we to try to divide the world into a confrontation, the numbers may not be with us.
Yeah, indeed. Pardon my cough there. Michael, listening on AM 760 in Denver, Colorado. You're on the air with Professor Stephen Cohen.
Good afternoon, Professor and Tom. I want to make a quick comment here and get your opinion. I've read a lot. I just finished a book by David McCullough, Truman, a biography, a lot about what post-World War II Europe and what was going on in the world at that time. I've come to believe that there's never really existed communism except for on the written page. Karl Marx, Friedrich Engels, whatever. Everything that has transpired to this day has been either a fascist form of totalitarianism or a left-wing pseudo-communist form of totalitarianism. If you can give me a book where that might be confirmed by someone, I'd love to read it. Now, I'm reading 1914 right now, Tom. I'll give you an idea of why the World War I started. But that's my comment. If there's a book or anything, and am I right in starting to think that, boy, after World War II, we did a great disservice not to try to work with the Soviets, different political system, but to say, hey, we're the victors. Let's get together here and rebuild the world.
Thank you.
That's my comment.
The last question about what we should have done after World War II would take us where I'm not sure Tom wants to go right now.
You can go anywhere you want.
The first question is very profound. What is this thing we've called communism in the 20th century? My own teacher, mentor, friend, best man at my wedding, Robert C. Tucker, whose two-volume biography of Stalin is surely the best that exists. He died at 92, 2-3 years ago. He believed that every communism, every regime that called itself communist was national, and that therefore Russian communism would be different from Chinese communism or from Polish communism or from Cuban communism. Because it can only be stable, the idea of communism, the ideology, if it integrates with the national traditions of a country. So Tucker has a book. I don't remember the exact title, but Communism and Political Culture is in the title. It's a collection of his essays on that subject. There are two Robert Tuckers. You want to look up Robert C. Tucker, and there you may get a very scholarly reply. Briefly, I'll tell you an anecdote that I've never forgotten.
We just have a half a minute.
Back in the 1950s, the leader of the French Communist Party was asked how he, a man of the left, could support Moscow. And his answer was, Moscow's not the left, it's the East.
Mm.
That's something that seems to me to be sensible.
Yeah, indeed. I absolutely agree. And for the record, let me say that there are, in my mind, no limits on what you can say or what opinions you could express on this program at all. I may disagree with you, but if so, I'll say so. But so far, everything...
It just, I didn't know. If we start with who began the Cold War after 1945, we will be here at least until the next World War.
Oh, so that's what you meant. In other words, it would take so long that we don't have time for the show.
I don't want to go subject-wise.
Okay, I understand perfectly.
Sorry.
I just didn't want my listeners to think that we get guests on and say, here's the list of things you can't talk. We don't do that here. Stephen Cohen is with us. We'll be back with more of your calls and questions for Stephen Cohen right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out Professor Cohen's new piece in The Nation magazine, Distorting Russia, How the American Media Misrepresented Putin, Sochi, and Ukraine, TheNation.com. Welcome back. You're still with us, Dr. Cohen?
I am.
Steve? Okay. Jerry in Long Island, New York, listening on WBAI. You're on the air with Dr. Cohen.
Yeah, thank you very much for taking my call, and welcome to your guests. Now, I have a question for you, Professor Cohen. I have a comment and a question. First of all, my comment is this. We have this push now by the military-industrial complex, the defense contractors, to waste more taxpayer money on this time on this new F-35 Joint Strike fighter jet, which is designed to fight Russian and Chinese aircraft, with the Pentagon reportedly planning to buy at least 100 a year of these new F-35 fighter jets, and according to 60 Minutes this past Sunday. And that leads me to my question. To what extent, I'd like to know from your guest, Professor Cohen, to what extent would you agree with me that it's a great mistake to overlook the degree to which the military-industrial complex, the defense contractors, are really behind trying to stir up a new Cold War with Russia in order for these defense contractors to stir up more business for themselves?
So Jerry's kind of echoing my conspiracy theory.
Well, it's not conspiracy. It's business. Business isn't a conspiracy. They just are a little quiet about it.
Yeah.
Jerry, first of all, we got to feel sorry for Jerry, who's probably been snowbound out on Long Island for 2 weeks. You know, Jerry, it's a driving force. Is it the most important one? I don't know. It is a one, but still worse. Russia has a military-industrial complex. They fell on very hard times with the end of the Soviet Union, and Russia became demodernized. It suffered in the 90s, partly thanks to what we recommended as economic policy called shock therapy. A worse depression, statistically, than we experienced in the 1930s. One argument in Russia about how to remodernize the country is to let the military-industrial complex do it. It was so big in the Soviet system. It's the most technological sector they have. So fund them. Give them the wealth. They'll drive it. They'll create jobs. They'll build infrastructure. We've heard this argument from other laggardly countries that military industrialization is the quickest and best way. Plus, you get a bang for the buck. You get a lot of security.
Well, it worked for us in the late 40s, or in the early 40s, rather.
Exactly. Other people say, no, 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 you don't want to do that. That's not good for the people. This argument goes on. But what we do know, Jerry, is that the two military-industrial complexes, Russian and American, they feed off each other. There was a great meeting at one point between Eisenhower and Khrushchev back in the 50s. Khrushchev had some military experience, but not much. And he hadn't consolidated his power. And his generals kept coming to him in the 50s and saying, you know, the Americans got this new weapon. We got to get it, too. And, you know, the Americans have more of this. We got to get more of this. So Khrushchev said to Eisenhower, do you ever hear that from your generals? And Eisenhower said, Nikita, or whatever he called Khrushchev, I hear it every day. But, you know, I got an advantage. I was a general. I know what they're up to. And I tell them to go F themselves. The pressure that a military-industrial staff can bring on a civilian president, when they come in and tell scare stories about how their country's falling behind and is vulnerable, is a driving force. And I think that we are spitting distance as we talk from a new nuclear arms race. And what's driving it today are these missile defense installations we're building. Because Russia understands that the best defense against them are more short-range nuclear missiles. That missile defense system, which is problematic in Germany, its workability is highly unlikely. Nonetheless, it's trillions and trillions of dollars of investment. You know, there used to be a...
Hang on just a second, please. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, and on the line with us, the author of the new piece, the new cover story in The Nation, Distorting Russia, How the American Media Misrepresent Putin, Sochi, and the Ukraine, Professor Stephen Cohen, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies and Politics at NYU in Princeton. And did you want to finish a thought, sir?
Well, people often ask, why are we building a missile defense system, which many scientists tell us really can't work? That's another story of why it won't work. And what comes to my mind is a joke that used to be told about the United States Congress. And the question was, what is an indestructible military weapon? And it's one funded in all 50 states.
There you go. Yeah.
And now we've got a missile defense system that's being funded in every NATO country plus Israel and a few others.
Yeah.
It's good for the business of these countries, and they know it won't work, but they're happy to take the installations and take the money.
Back
driving the arms race.
Yeah. In 1964, I was 13 years old, and I went door-to-door with my dad for Barry Goldwater. 3 years later, I was, you know, getting arrested and tear-gassed in East Lansing in anti-war protests and as part of SDS. But I remember that mentality of the Russians are going to bury you. And they, in fact, the quote was taken out of context, apparently, but it was used so widely. Well, actually, we've got a caller who I think may be bringing this topic up. David in Chicago, you have a quick question for Professor Cohen.
Hi, Professor Cohen. I haven't read any of your works yet. I look forward to reading this story, this article in The Nation. I haven't read Tucker, but I've read Simon Sebag, Montefiore, Donald Rayfeld, and Conquest, Harvest of Sorrow. So I'm very familiar with this topic. I feel like given recent events, of the 60 Minutes piece this past Sunday on corruption in Russia, and then what happened to Mr. Kraft, the New England Patriots having his ring stolen by Putin, and then the State Department covering that up. I wonder how much of that business influence has been on the current events. But getting back to the history, we want to have history be our guide, not our master. But given the murderous regimes under the Bolshevik Soviets, of 60 million people around being murdered by their own government, I think a lot of people cannot be sanguine about this country and how they've never really reformed. And remember, it was Putin's grandfather that worked in the kitchens of Lenin and Stalin, and that's how he was tracked to get into the KGB. So I think that's why people find this regime problematic, despite Putin's recovering the economy, you know, with the sovereign wealth fund. Yeah. We see this corruption today, and the murderous and this 60 Minutes piece really brings a poignancy to current problems that find Russia problematic for Americans.
The 60 Minute piece, you're referring to the profile they did of William Browder.
Exactly.
I'm going to tell you right now.
Thank you, David.
That you can absolutely not trust that man's version of what happened to him in Russia. You cannot. You ask him how he made billions of dollars in Russia in the 1990s. But here's the larger implication of what you just said. Let's say you're right. That means that a people, the Russian people now, are condemned in our judgment forever for what their leaders did 50, 60, 100 years ago. If we did that, Germany wouldn't be our dear friend today.
If we did that, we wouldn't be our dear friend. We had slaves.
We wouldn't be our dear friend. That's correct. So, I mean, at some point, you got to draw the line. And you're right. History is a judge, and Russia has historical impulses. But I don't think Putin is a murderer. I don't think he's a killer. I don't think his regime is murderers. I mean, I'm a Henny Youngman man, the famous Borscht Belt comedian. When asked, how's your wife, he said, compared to what? If you tell me, is Putin a killer, I would ask you, compared to whom? I mean, yeah, he's killed, his forces have killed Chechen terrorists and Islamic terrorists in the North Caucasus, who are fighting, by the way, now in Syria and Afghanistan and other places. But to call him a murderer and imply that he brought about the death of a political opponent, there is no evidence. I know people talk about it. I guarantee you there's not a shred of evidence. And in one case, the case of this Russian KGB defector who was poisoned in London by polonium a few years ago, it's not even clear the guy was murdered. Scotland Yard will not release the autopsy. We don't know how the guy died, but it's equally possible he was carrying around that polonium in his pocket to sell it, to try to show he could get polonium on the black market. It leaked into his system. And the only reason that Scotland Yard might not release it, I digress briefly, but to show you what the media does, is that the autopsy may show there was far more polonium in him than in the so-called teacup he drank. So these charges, Putin's, I don't want Putin married any of my daughters. I don't want Putin as my president, but that's not what we're talking about. This business that he's a thug and a killer is undermining our national security. It's got to stop. We've got to have priorities.
Yeah, we've done business with a lot of, we only have 1 minute left. John has a question. The next question I was going to put up was, could the TPP be related to Russia and Ukraine? But let me, I'll throw that out. But, you know, we have a minute to wrap it up if there's a point you want to make.
No, the point is, Tom, is that what you and I are talking about here today is something that needs to be talked about in the mainstream media. I'm not prepared to sit here and say I'm right and the people who say I'm wrong are wrong. But if we can't get a discussion of the kind we should have in a democratic society going about the most fundamental questions of national security, we're in for rough times. And they're being adumbrated, foreshadowed in those fires burning in Kiev as we talk.
Yeah. And so our response should be to encourage both our press and our politicians to engage in conversation rather than simplistic rhetoric?
I mean, a good question is better than a lousy answer. And our media is full of lousy answers, and they don't tolerate new questions.
Yeah, it seems like that's our truism for the day. Professor Stephen Cohen, contributing editor to The Nation, professor emeritus of Russian studies and politics at NYU and Princeton. His most recent article, Distorting Russia, How the American Media Misrepresents Putin, Sochi, and the Ukraine. It's in The Nation, the March 3rd edition, thenation.com. And, of course, on bookstands. And his book, which is now out in paperback, is Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, which examines the new Cold War. Professor Cohen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
It's been an honor and a pleasure to talk. We'll be back. We'll be back tomorrow. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartmann. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartmann here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartmann program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. W-I-X, Wix.com. Everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.